This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. Sleep. Few of us get enough of it. Most of us crave more. And sleep seems to be vanishing before our eyes. The Secret Life of Sleep is the new book by Kat Duff. She's on the phone with me right now to talk about sleep, why we know so much about it, yet so little. Good to have you on Cincinnati Edition, Kat. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
We have to start right at the beginning. At the beginning of the book, you say birds do it, bees do it, salamanders do it, even roundworms do it. Sleep is more than a creature comfort. It is a requirement for life on this planet. Why do we sleep?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. But it's becoming, we're finding more and more reasons to sleep. It's incredibly rejuvenating of our minds, our bodies, our emotions. We get rid of toxins, we rebuild our tissues, we sort out our emotional problems. So much goes on in sleep. It's such a valuable resource, and we're all endowed with it. It's part of our endowment as creatures on this planet that rotates in alternating days and nights.
We not only does everybody sleep, but everybody has trouble sleeping at times, too. Why is this weird kind of juxtaposition of something that's so needed yet so difficult at times?
Well, that is a hard question to answer, but it seems like every economic and technological development eats away at our sleep. The age of industrialization, when people started working out of their homes, then you made them squeeze their sleep into a shorter period of time. When electricity came on and we lit up our nights, the light started keeping us awake at night. We have our LED screens that emit a lot of blue light, which is the very frequency that keeps us awake. It's great for waking up in the morning to turn on the computer or the TV or check your email on your phone, but at night it'll start keeping you awake. So all of these factors, all the demands on our time, and also our kind of bad attitudes about sleep. We think we can kick it aside, we can sacrifice it, we can get to it later. That becomes its own problem.
Well, you state that 60% of Americans experience a sleep problem at least twice a week. Is this a real sleep problem or a perceived sleep problem? Because reading your book, I kind of found it could be more perception than reality.
That statistic comes from a study where they just asked people, you know, have you had trouble sleeping a few nights this past week. So it was their perception. Sometimes we think we slept better than we did. Other times we think we didn't sleep when we did sleep. And so it's a tricky thing. But the best way to know whether you got enough sleep is to notice whether you're tired during the day, if you're struggling against feeling sleepy or drowsy and having to get that, you know, double-sized Coke or that extra cup of coffee. That's when you know that you aren't getting enough sleep.
You talk about how we slept before industrialization, how we would really sleep twice a night rather than one continuous sleep. Has it been the demands of the modern world that have affected our sleep so much?
Well, I believe so, because our bodies are really entrained to the natural world, to the coming and going of light, to the change of seasons. That's what our bodies naturally respond to. And you know, back in the 1990s, they did this interesting study where they took these students and they put them in a place where they would have 14 hours of darkness, like what our ancestors did before we had lights. And they naturally fell into sleeping twice a night. It seems to be a natural way. And most mammals will sleep a couple of times a day. In fact, a lot of people now wake up in the middle of the night and worry that it's a big problem that they woke up, when in fact it's natural. Our bodies are built to alternate between periods of activity and sleep. And if you didn't get enough sleep at night, it's great to take a nap during the day if you can. That can catch up a lot and really refresh.
Speaking with Kat Duff, the author of The Secret Life of Sleep, talking about sleep and how few of us get enough of it, and a lot of us crave a lot more of it. And you also quote in your book how 80% of Americans believe you can't be successful at work and get enough sleep, that a lack of sleep is kind of a requirement for success. Does that go back to that perception and reality thing? Is this something, you know, are we imposing these sleep problems upon ourselves?
To some extent we are, because we buy into that myth that the best don't rest, or you snooze, you lose. It's a, in a way, kind of a uniquely American myth. You could go back to Ben Franklin, who said, hey, there'll be plenty of time to sleep in the grave. You got to get to work now, you know. But in fact, when we aren't getting enough sleep, we're really spinning our wheels, and we're not as productive. We can't think as clearly. We're more reactive. We're causing more problems, getting in more accidents. We do better just to get the sleep we need.
Well, you know, human fascination with sleep goes back millennia, as it's obvious in your book, because you have quotes that cover centuries. This is not really something new. Everyone thinks it's, you know, their problem and something new in their life, but really this is sleep's been something that's been fascinating to humans for centuries.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things I discovered was that in Asian cultures and traditions, they observed sleep a lot more carefully than we did here in the West, and studied sleep, valued sleep, considered it to be a valuable part of the day, even sometimes more valuable than our daily lives. And a lot of what they learned through observation about the stages of sleep, deep sleep, dream sleep, has been confirmed by the scientific studies of the last few decades here in the West.
Well, I was fascinated as well as you look at how different cultures in different parts of the world approach sleep. You just talked about the Asian approach. For some, it's communal. For others, it's an isolated and isolating activity. And, you know, you quote how Americans have so much trouble with sleep, but it seems to be an American and European problem for the most part.
Especially. That was one of the things that most surprised me when I started researching sleep, was to learn that what I thought was just natural and normal to human sleep, which is you go to bed in your bedroom and you fight it off when you're a kid because you don't want to, or you fight it off when you're grown up because you'd rather do other things. But in fact, historically, cross-culturally, people slept much closer to each other. And in fact, in most every other culture, it was assumed that an infant that first year would sleep within arm's reach of their caregiver. If you talk to someone in another culture where that's the habit, they would think it was cruel, the things we do where we put babies in their own rooms and let them cry it out. They wouldn't understand that. So I realized that there, to some extent, culture shapes our experience of sleep.
You know, you mentioned the babies, and I know there's a big debate here in this country about co-sleeping, where a mother or parents are sleeping with the child in their bed as well. The National Pediatric Association, I think, recommends that, ABC, alone, on their back, and in a crib without anything around it. But it seems that most other cultures would find that, as you've already mentioned, contrary.
Yeah, well, and the Pediatric Society now does recommend that you have that baby in the room with you, not in a separate room, even if they're in a crib or a trundle bed or, you know, a little carrier next to you. The concern about sleeping with a baby is because we have all these pillows and all these soft mattresses and have plenty of people who are using drugs or alcohol, and that does make it unsafe. But in other cultures, they wouldn't dream of doing that when you're with your little baby.
Well, you talk a lot in the book, too, about how a huge industry has sprung up around sleep. There's sleep studies, sleep techniques, and, of course, sleep drugs. Does this commercial exploitation of sleep help contribute to our feeling of a lack of sleep? Since, as you note, you watch TV, hard to watch TV without seeing some sleep aid commercial.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. The sleep industry makes a good $20 billion a year, and that's rapidly increasing. And in 1997, the FDA approved direct-to-consumer advertising, and that's when we started seeing all those sleeping pill ads. And that does worry people, oh my God, maybe I'm not getting enough sleep. We read all these things about you need to have 8 hours of sleep, you need this, you need that, and people start worrying more, and when you worry more, then you can't sleep as well, and it becomes this kind of vicious cycle. So at this point, 1 out of 4 Americans takes a sleeping pill every night.
Wow.
And it's kind of absurd when you think about it, because we're born knowing how to sleep. It's a natural endowment, a function of being a creature on this planet. Somehow we've allowed our sleep to be corroded and eaten away by the different demands on our time, the different forces of, you know, light and economics and all sorts of things. We haven't protected our sleep, and now we're beginning to notice it. Just like when we didn't protect our water, we began to realize, oh my gosh, the water quality is going down, we're not having enough water. I consider sleep to be a really valuable natural resource that we need to protect.
Kat Duff, author of The Secret Life of Sleep, available in bookstores now. You can learn more about it at WVXU.org. And Kat, you cover a lot of the science and also some of the spiritual approaches when it comes to sleep, but I find it intriguing when you write in the book about that time between sleep and wakefulness, whether it's when you're falling to sleep or waking up from sleep, how our minds and our bodies are perceiving the world slightly differently. And it's quite fascinating. It's not something you think about because, as you said, it's ubiquitous. It's something you do every day.
Absolutely. And those times of transition in and out of sleep, as well as those times when we might wake up in the middle of the night for a while and then fall back asleep, those are, scientifically, they're known as kind of mixed states of part asleep, part awake. Historically, they've been very valuable. People come to realize things, have insights. A lot of artists and even inventors would turn to those states for ideas. Edison, he was a famous napper. And he would hold steel balls in his hands while he was sitting in his chair and wait for himself to fall asleep and those balls to fall on the floor and wake him up, and then he'd try to grab an idea right then and there. He was literally mining that drowsy, half-asleep, half-awake state for its immense creativity and imaginativeness.
It's funny how there's a lot of anecdotal evidence like that, and people like Thomas Edison who appreciates the benefits of sleep, but we still don't really know a lot about how our minds perceive and why our minds perceive that world so differently at dusk and dawn.
I know. It's very interesting, isn't it? And it's one of the things I like about sleep is even though we have learned so much about it and there's so much research about it, it still has mysteries to it and things we don't understand, things we don't fully get. And I love the presence of that mystery. A friend of mine called my book a love poem to sleep. I love that quality about it.
Well, dreams are given a lot of attention in your book. You cover the neuroscience and anthropology of sleeps and dreaming and some scientific studies that have been done. But you also kind of get a very spiritual tone when you're talking about dreams and dreaming. Kind of a new age bend. Why and what do you find so important about dreams?
Well, you know, when I did my historical and cross-cultural research, one of the things that became very evident is that dreams have played an important role in every religious tradition that I could find. Every religious text, you know, describes dreams. And peoples the world over have turned to their dreams for guidance, for insight. So it's really just been in this short spell of time, this modern age, in the primarily, you know, European, North American context, that we have started to disown and pretend that it's gibberish, our dreams, and that, you know, they don't mean anything. That's a really kind of a speck in the big picture.
A speck, and you give a couple of examples there, and I'm sure many people have examples of dreams, but again, they step back from it. But back to our lack of sleep, you know, is it our focus today on time and productivity that's really interfering with our natural sleep pattern? You know, the book is not necessarily how to sleep better. You just explore the world of sleep and the secret life of sleep, as the title says. But you don't offer any advice. We have to figure that out for ourselves.
Yes, to some extent. And, you know, there's advice all, you know, we're we're bombarded with advice all the time. My goal is to re-engage people in their own sleep and their own sleep experiences. And it is very individual. We can come up with statistics that say people do best with 8 to 10 hours of sleep. But in fact, everyone is individual. Some people, I need 9 hours of sleep to do well. Other people only need 7 hours of sleep or 6 hours of sleep. The way you know if you're getting enough sleep is if you're fighting drowsiness during the day. If that is happening, then you probably aren't getting enough. But it is an individual relationship, just like our relationship to our dreams is very individual.
And it's also easy to lean on those commercial entities who will provide you a way to go to sleep, but that still doesn't help your sleep in the long run, according to your book.
No, the studies on sleep medications indicate that they give you an average of 11, some say 14 minutes of sleep, so not a whole lot more. And in the meantime, when we're taking sleep medications, we're getting less time in the deep, physically restorative sleep. That's when we regenerate our tissues and strengthen our immunity and make memories and improve our mood, all that important. We spend less time in that deep sleep. We spend less time in the dreaming REM sleep. So what happens is that with chronic use of sleeping pills, we actually accelerate our aging. That isn't to say that sleeping pills don't have their use, because going without sleep night after night is a big problem as well. And not getting enough sleep is a problem. But I encourage people to do everything they can in their own lives and lifestyles to sustain their sleep before they turn to pills.
As you researched this book and did so extensively, what have you changed in your sleep patterns, Kat? What have you done to improve your sleep?
Well, one of the things is that when I wake up in the middle of the night, I don't get scared that I'm going to lose sleep now and I'm going to be a wreck tomorrow, because I know it's a natural thing. And I actually have come to enjoy those, you know, hours here and there. I also bring more problems to my sleep. Even simple things like I don't know what to get someone for their birthday, you know, cannot think of a present. I just think about that person before I go to sleep, and inevitably the next morning I have an idea. There's a lot of problems you can take to your sleep, and your sleep will work on it while you're resting and rejuvenating.
It's fascinating, and as I've read the book, I just want to go to sleep, not because it's boring, but because it sounds like so much fun. So I greatly appreciate your time and wisdom, Kat.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. Thanks very much.
Kat Duff, the award-winning author of The Alchemy of Illness. Her new book is The Secret Life of Sleep, available where books are sold. You'll find a link to the book and more on our website, wvxu.org. It's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell.